So any questions, like on the problems or anything before we start? All right. Now, I believe there's usually some sort of like omnipresent AV person watching. So if there is, can you give me a little shout so I know you're there?
I'm here.
Oh, great. Okay. So I was going to show some slides today and maybe like 30 minutes through the lecture. So how do I do that? How do I turn this thing
If you want, you can just let me know when you want the projector to come down, and I can put it down for you.
Oh, okay, great, great. All right, about 30 minutes, and I'll give you a shot.
Great.
Thanks, IT, omnipresent IT goddess. Okay, so last time we. When I left off last time, I was actually talking about more of a statistics thing, I guess, than a physics thing. I was talking about Gaussian random variables. So for a Gaussian random vector, that is an object with a discrete index I that runs from 1 to n, the covariance of the Gaussian is a matrix. In the 2 by 2 case, a Gaussian in 2 dimensions is specified by its error ellipse. Which, you need 3 numbers to specify there's an error in each direction and then an off-diagonal correlation. And in the n dimensional case, you would need, n times n minus 1 over 2 off-diagonal correlations to fully specify the covariance. So I had left off with the question last time, if someone just gave you this matrix numerically, gave you, say, a 100 by 100 matrix, how you might on the computer simulate 100 random numbers Xi whose covariance or two-point function is equal to the specified Cij. Does anyone have any overnight inspiration on how you might do this? You're not alone, actually. Like when I was a starting PhD student, I remember writing some like ridiculously complicated code for the 3x3 case until after spending a little time working on it, I realized what was really going on. So one way to think about it is that there's a theorem. So a trivial case would be if the matrix is diagonal. Let's say the covariance matrix just had 0 off-diagonals, and then the diagonal element you interpret as sort of the square fluctuation in a random number.
The expectation, this is the expectation value, right?
Yes, this.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's right. So then in the diagonal case, the algorithm is you just simulate n independent Gaussians where the RMS or amplitude of each Gaussian is sigma I. And then there's a theorem in linear algebra that you can always diagonalize a general matrix. So given a general matrix Cij, there'll be some rotation R which converts it to a diagonal matrix of this type, say delta for diagonal. In the 2x2 case, there's always some rotation. If I have this ellipse, there's some rotation that will line it up with the axes. And the same is true in the n-dimensional case. There's some global rotation of the n-dimensional space that lines everything up, makes the principal axes of the ellipse the same as the axes of the coordinate system. So you just simulate in this basis and then apply R inverse to the vector that you get to go back to the original basis. And this is kind of what's going on in random fields where, as I'll explain next, in the case where you have field degrees of freedom instead of a finite number of degrees of freedom, you could think of the Fourier transform as sort of like a big rotation on function space, where you naturally think of fields as being defined in position space where the covariance is non-diagonal. But in Fourier space is the basis that diagonalizes the covariance matrix and allows things to be simulated simply. Okay, so that was random vectors. Let's talk about random fields. So I'm only going to talk about a scalar field. So if phi, scalar field phi of x, where x is, let's say, a 3D position. It's a random field. So let's say let phi of x be a random field. I'm just going to assume translational and rotational symmetry throughout. So what's the analog, if we think of each degree of freedom in this field as being, say each point in space, as being like one value of the discrete index here, then what's the analog of the covariance matrix Cij? So that depends on, the notation for writing that covariance down depends on which basis you're working in. So in position space, it's the correlation function. So I just take the expectation value of phi at two points in space. The argument to the function here you think of as being like the discrete index here. So this is some function without translation and rotation invariance. This would just be a general function of two points x and y on the right-hand side, just like the covariance matrix here just has two indices. But under the assumption of the symmetries, the right-hand side only depends on the distance between the two points. And furthermore, it only depends on the absolute value of the distance. And so this function on the right-hand side is the two-point function, how you represent the two-point function in a real space, and it's called the correlation function. It's pretty intuitive. The correlation function at a given separation is positive if, say, a positive fluctuation of the field here is statistically associated with a random fluctuation over here with the same sign, also positive. And then there's the power spectrum. Which is just the two-point function in Fourier space. So So a particular realization of the field, of course, will not be translation invariant because it has fluctuations. But what we mean is that the statistics are translation invariant. So if I shift the whole field over, the precise criterion is that if what I mean by translation invariance is that if I have a random realization and I shift it over by some translation, I get another field realization with the same probability of occurrence. Okay. And then in the Fourier basis, we usually define the two-point function with a star here. You could define it without the star, in which case the delta function would just have a different sign in it. As we argued last time, what the translation invariance means here is that the right-hand side has to include this delta function. You might also, you know, be familiar with this from, say, QFT, where in Fourier space, an endpoint function in QFT always has a delta function on the right-hand side in the total momentum of the process. And that's just Noether's theorem for the translation symmetry. Okay. Now, so this function P of K is called the power spectrum. The way you think about the power spectrum intuitively is that the value of the power spectrum at some wave number k is just telling you about the average size of a fluctuation at that wavelength. So the shape of this in k is just comparing the size of the fluctuations at different wavelengths to each other. Okay. Now what if you had n fields? N random fields, which might be correlated with each other. How would the correlation function change? How would you modify this object on the right hand side? I'm just kind of asking for fun. We're not gonna maybe we'll use this later. You just kind of follow your nose and start adding indices. If I had an index here, and then this could be a different index, then to fully describe the statistics, I have two indices on the right-hand side. And I'm not assuming anything about how the fields are related to each other. This object, theta ij, could just be a dense matrix. But it's still, that matrix only depends on the separation. So at every separation, you have an n by general n by n matrix.
This would just be a
If they're correlated, then this should be, if they're not correlated, then this should be proportional to the delta function, right? Because the single, there would be a disadvantage if they follow Gaussian statistics.
Do you mean you want to have a delta ij here?
If they're uncorrelated, it should be zero, right? Because if there was just one random field and another one, then it's basically this vectorizes into two one-point functions that they would disadvantage. If they're not the same, then this should be zero, right?
Sounds like maybe you're saying that if the fields are independent of each other, then I would have a delta ij on the right-hand side, and I could get away with just having a single index there. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, if they're uncorrelated to each other, then there should be nothing going on. So why can't we just put Cij?
I may not understand what you mean. How do you want to modify this?
I'm just looking at this xi, xj, cij. I mean, this is the same situation, right? We have two random variables with indices.
That's exactly right. But there's you can really think of this. Here you can think of the index as being a combination of a discrete field label and a space-time point. You see what I mean? So if I wasn't assuming any symmetry at all, then the right-hand side would be schematically, something that depended on, this index and this index. But because of the translation symmetry, this really is just a function of the separation x minus y. And so it's natural to think of that as like a matrix of functions of one variable. So likewise, in Fourier space, if these guys each have an index, the power spectrum is still diagonal. The covariance in the Fourier basis is still diagonal in K. I still have this delta function. But now the power spectrum, I could have any cross power spectrum between the field I and the field J. So in general, the power spectrum, is just an independent dense matrix for every value of K. A situation, learned a little bit in the first class about CMB polarization. That this sort of situation occurs in the CMB where there's sort of three fields. There's a CMB temperature. Now, these are actually 2D fields defined. And in fact, they're 2D fields that live in angular coordinates. So they're strictly speaking defined on the surface of a sphere. But the math works similarly. And in the CMB, just to give an example where we have to think about this sort of setup, you probably know that there are three fields we observe. There's a temperature, a so-called E-mode polarization, and the super interesting and hard to measure B-mode polarization. And so what happens in the CMB is that for every wave number, which is going to be a 2D wave number L, we have a 3x3 matrix, which gives the power spectrum for 2D fields. We usually write the power spectrum C instead of P for just as a notational convention. So in the CMB, there's a little 3x3 matrix. There's a temperature power spectrum, which is what people mean by default when they say the CMB power spectrum. There's a TE cross power spectrum, an EE auto power spectrum. And then likewise, just the general 3x3 matrix, there's a TB cross power spectrum, an EB cross power spectrum, BB, EB, TB. Just as an aside, the parity symmetry of the universe turns out, this is not something that's supposed to be obvious at all, but just something that I'll say, to set the cross correlations between B and the other fields to zero, which is why you rarely see, for example, the measured, and they're observed to be consistent with zero, TB power spectrum plotted in papers and talks. But it is sometimes something that can be used to constrain like exotic physics that where you'd see parity violations.
Question about how do you actually
roll
about doing this calculation stuff? If you have to, phi I, phi j, and you want to calculate their expectation value of their product. How do you define that?
Oh, that's a great question. Okay, so do you mean, there are two possible calculations you might mean. One is I have some physical theory, and I want to calculate in that theory what is the theory prediction for, say, this power spectrum. And the other thing that you might mean is that, now I want to compare that theory to data. I have some measurement, maybe with some measurement noise, of the field, of a realization of the field. How do I estimate the power spectrum?
Yeah, basically I want to say, like, what, how do I calculate these brackets? Like, you know, what do they mean?
Yeah, okay, okay. Well, so, in, depends on the context where you're asking the question. So, one thing that we're going to calculate is the power spectrum at the end of inflation. So for any field that you wanted to ask about, let's say the adiabatic curvature, which I defined last time, you might be wondering, so inflation generates the fluctuations, the initial fluctuations in the adiabatic curvature. And so you might be wondering, what is the power spectrum? So how do I calculate this expectation value? There, the origin of the fluctuations is a quantum mechanical mechanism. So what the expectation on the left-hand side will really mean is a quantum mechanical expectation value, or just, you know, the expectation value of an operator. And, you know, we're going to do, I'll talk about this, I'll give maybe one lecture on it. We'll do sort of a first principles quantum mechanics calculation of what you get here. And show how you reproduce the observed power spectrum, which is, you know, something like a small number. Roughly what it looks like is a small number of order 10 to the minus 9 over k to an exponent, which is a little bit smaller than 3, 2.96. Another question you might ask is, this is the power spectrum of the universe at the end of inflation. But then all this interesting physics processes it after that to produce, say, the CMB power spectrum and other observables. So, you know, you might ask, let's say I consider a different field, say, the density field at redshift 0. That's a power spectrum that I can observe. I can go and measure all the matter in the universe, say, by counting up all the galaxies which roughly trace the matter. Can measure that field, can Fourier transform it, square it, and measure the power spectrum of this field delta rho, and then compare the power spectrum that I get. This is what's sometimes called the matter power spectrum to theory. Now, the way that the theory prediction would work in this case is that you would do a bunch of linear perturbation theory. So this, at least on wavelengths where linear perturbation theory is a good approximation, which turns out to be wavelengths that are larger than a characteristic scale around 30 megaparsecs. So on scales where the universe is well described by linear perturbation theory, this field, the matter fluctuation that we observe today, is just linearly related to the initial conditions, to the initial adiabatic curvature. If that's true, then a general statement that I can make is that the relationship between them is diagonal in K. So each wave number of the matter fluctuation that I observe today is related by some k-dependent linear multiplier to the same Fourier mode in the initial conditions. Why does it have to be diagonal in k? Why couldn't this guy receive a contribution from zeta at some other wave number? That's just translation invariance again. If there was such a contribution, then displacing the whole universe, I'd apply some phase e to the ik prime times delta x here, and some different phase here, and get a contradiction. Relationship would not be translation invariant. So, the actual calculation of this transfer function T of k involves all of the physics that takes place between inflation and today. So that's like the linear acoustic physics of the CMB, the propagation of sound waves in the CMB, the slow growth of structure by gravitational collapse in the late universe. I'm going to try to cover as much of that physics as possible in the course, but it's a lot, so I might not be able to do it in 2 weeks. or 2.5 weeks. There are, for example, if you want a black box approach, there are like public codes that you can download, a code called CAMB and a similar code called class, where you just run the code and in like 1 second it will tell you, it will spit out this function as a function of K. This very complicated black box that takes you from diagonal and K black box that takes you from the initial fluctuations to what we see in the late universe. So computing this is super complicated, but then once you've computed it, I'm really glad you're asking this question because this is all, they're all sort of introductory comments that I should have made up front. Once you've computed it, you now have the information that you need to compute the power spectrum. You just take the square of this transfer function times whatever power spectrum inflation gave you. That's the 10 to the minus 9 over k to the 2.96. That's sort of at a cartoon level how you calculate most things that we observe in cosmology today. This is actually how we constrain cosmological parameters because, you know, measuring this, which you indirectly measure when you measure this, is telling you about the parameters of inflation. This transfer function depends on all the cosmological parameters. It depends on omega baryon, omega matter, and so on, the parameters that don't appear here. So those parameters end up imprinting themselves on observables. Thanks for asking that question. So I'm going to just do a few calculations to sort of illustrate how you calculate things with random fields. Maybe I'll start with just a super simple one, which is if I have a random field with power spectrum P of K, Fi is a random field.
Build a model that would give you the initial power spectrum of, say, curvature perturbations, and then you measure the perturbations of matter.
You don't really get to measure this, right? Because you can't look all the way back to the end of inflation.
No, exactly. Yeah. But you build a model for that, for the inflation.
Right.
And then you're looking for the transfer function, so that's what you're looking for?
What you get to measure is this quantity, which combines the transfer function and the power spectrum of the initial conditions. There's many observables that have this qualitative form. It's not the case that the matter field is the only thing in the universe you can measure. We can also measure the CMB, which is a different field linearly related to the initial curvature perturbations with a different power spectrum. By measuring many things at once, it's not really the case that there's like one thing in the universe that contains all of the information about cosmological parameters. Like the CMB is one part piece of the puzzle. We measure the square of one transfer function time with some dependence on cosmological parameters times the initial power spectrum. Then we measure the matter fluctuations at low redshift, which have a different power spectrum. And by putting all the pieces together, we can constrain all the cosmological parameters, or hope to constrain all the cosmological parameters. Let phi be a random field with power spectrum P of K. What's the typical or RMS size? RMS stands for root mean square of a fluctuation in phi. So So by definition, what I want to calculate is the square root of the expectation value of phi squared. That's the definition of the RMS delta phi. Sorry, phi squared means I take phi at a point x, take its, you know, square it at that same point, take the expectation value, and then take the 1/2 power. Okay, well, since the power spectrum is the two-point function in Fourier space, then I'm going to start by converting phi of x to Fourier space. So I have two factors of phi of x here. One of them, if I unpack it, gives a 5k e to the ik dot x. And then the other one gives another integral. At the same point x. Okay. Now, we'll bring the integrals to the outside. And put the expectation value here. And then I'll replace now I've converted the original expression, which is a two-point function in real space, to the an expression involving the two-point function in Fourier space, which allows me to use the definition of the power spectrum. So I just get a P of k. Now, remind me what delta function I get here. It's k plus k prime, because there's no star. And this is all to the 1/2. Oops. All right, so.
So where's the integral over x that is generating the delta function? I think we're not writing the delta function from the.
So the original expectation value was evaluated at a point x.
Yeah, we're changing rotation in between, I guess, right?
Sorry?
We're changing rotation between the second and the third line somehow, I guess, because. Okay.
What's maybe confusing is that the left-hand side here does not appear to depend on x. Whereas what I have here is phi evaluated at a particular point x. The point is that because the statistics are translation invariant, this expectation value doesn't depend on which point you choose to square the field at. So there is an x on the right-hand side, or not the left-hand side, but the choice of x should drop out at the end. Okay, so using the delta function to get rid of, by the way, a little blackboard typo, this 2 pi cubed should have been 2 pi to the 6, of course. So using the delta function to get rid of one of the k integrals, then I get this result. 2 pi cubed p of k. And with no phase, because the delta function set k plus k prime to 0. OK. So that's a nice simple result. Let's write this as a formula for delta phi squared. It's just each Fourier mode k contributes p of k to that total variance. Now, an alternate way that you can write this result, if this is a 3D integral over a function that only depends on the length of k, so it makes sense to just convert this to a 1D integral with a factor of 4 pi squared k squared.
So, the reason the delta is in the 5k prime? Is that it?
Oh yeah, that's right. That's right. Exactly. If there were a star here, then this would be a minus.
Okay.
Okay. So sometimes the result is written this way. First, I'm going to convert this to a 1D integral. Just putting in the factor of 4 pi k squared. And then I'll change variables from k to log k. I'll write the final result as the integral over log k of k cubed p of k over 2 pi squared. And so this quantity has a name, this quantity in parentheses. It's called delta squared of k. That's just defined to be k cubed over 2 pi squared p of k. And you think of it intuitively as the contribution to the power spectrum per log k, so for a fixed multiplicative increase in k. This in a given, say, decade of wave number, this is the contribution to the power spectrum. So you'll usually see, if you see power spectrum in plots, the reason I bring this up, first off, is because you'll see this symbol. And secondly, because when you see power spectra in plots, they're usually plotted with this factor of k cubed over 2 pi squared, so that the quantity on the x-axis is sort of, you know, can be interpreted intuitively as sort of the squared size of the fluctuations from one, say, factor of 2 or factor of e in scale. So if you see a plot without this factor of p of k, you should multiply it by k cubed over 2 pi squared in your head to interpret the numerical value. Okay, so that was one calculation. We just showed that the variance of a random field was the integral of the power spectrum. A very similar calculation, which I'm going to assign as homework, is to show more generally that the power spectrum p of k and the correlation function zeta of r are related to each other by Fourier transforms. In other words, if I start with the correlation function, which is, let me write it this way, where the expectation value on the right-hand side is, you know, really is going to turn out to be independent of the choice of x. Then, after some steps, you'll show that this is equal to the integral d3k over 2 pi cubed times the power spectrum p of k times it. Let's write this as a function of the separation times e to the I k dot r. And of course, because you know, the Fourier transform is its own inverse, so to speak, if you start from the power spectrum p of k, if you start from the correlation function zeta of r and take its Fourier transform, you'll go back to the power spectrum. Okay. Here's another calculation. I really want to show the slideshow. Okay. I'm going to do this calculation next time so that I can show the slideshow today. So, but I'll just state it because I'm going to use this fact in the slideshow. So stated without proof for now, but I'll give the proof first thing tomorrow, is that a field is scale invariant. Now this is something that I think you guys could show. If you do, you know, calculations along these lines, you'll be able to show it. If its power spectrum is proportional to 1 over k cubed, I'll give a formal proof of that next time. What scale invariant means is that if I have a realization of a random field in a box, and then I blow up a sub-box to the size of the original box if I magnify, then what I get is statistically indistinguishable from the original field. Now, you can actually kind of see this. I'll give a formal proof next time. But you can actually kind of see this by dimensional analysis. If phi is a dimensionless field, then the power spectrum P has units of volume, or k cubed P of k is dimensionless. That was sort of apparent here, where this is dimensionless, and log k is dimensionless, so the combination in parentheses has to be dimensionless for the units to work on. You can also, of course, see it directly from the definition. I'm going to point to the equation up here. So if phi is dimensionless, just to work through the units, if phi of x is dimensionless, then each Fourier mode phi of k, at least with the usual conventions, it's defined this way, then if phi of x is dimensionless, then phi of k has units of volume because of the d3x. And then when I take the power spectrum, this here's the equation that defines the power spectrum. Okay, this time I have the star, so I'll put k minus k prime here. I have something on the left-hand side with units of volume squared. And the delta function, it always has the inverse units of its argument. And this is really three delta functions. So the units here are the minus three power of a wave number, or volume. And so for the units to be consistent, the power spectrum has to have units of volume, which is the same thing as saying the power spectrum is units of volume, or k cubed p of k is dimensions. All right, so just by dimensional analysis, where a is constant, a field with this power spectrum, if the coefficient of A here is dimensionless, which means that it has to be scale invariant because I didn't have to specify any dimensionful parameters in order to define it. That's just sort of a way of seeing that it has to be 1 over k cubed by dimensional analysis. That same dimensional analysis argument would tell you that in 2D, scale invariant means by the way, as a cosmologist, I am just hardwired to use L as the wave number in two dimensions and to call the power spectrum CL. So if I try to write P of L, I just, like, the muscles in my arm physically can't do it, and I have to write CL. So if CL is proportional to 1 over L squared, that's the criterion for scale invariance in two dimensions. Okay. One more comment is that when we talk about 2D fields in cosmology, the two-dimensional domain of definition that we're talking about is always the sky. So I don't think I've ever invoked a 2D field in a published paper where it was defined on something other than the sky. So the L here, in 3D, k is a physical wave number. It has units of inverse length. But on the sky, L has units of, wavelengths are really measured in angles, like in degrees or radians. And wave numbers are measured in inverse degrees or inverse radians. Those comments, I'm going to show the slideshow. Okay. So the reason for the slideshow is that when you first introduce this mathematical machinery for describing random fields, I think the math is fairly clear, but it's hard to get sort of intuition for the what different types of power spectra represent. So it's just way easier to explain by pictures than in words. So here is a random realization of a scale invariant field. All of these are going to be 2D plots, so scale invariant means that the power spectrum is proportional to 1 over L squared. I think you can convince yourself by eye that this is scale invariant. There's sort of no preferred scale here. You just, as you sort of zoom in your head, you just see more, fluctuations of about the same size on smaller scales. In the next plot, I've tilted that. So relative to the scale invariant case, there's an L to the minus 1. So what that does is it puts more power on large scales. The power law nature of the power spectrum, and you can see here, there's, you know, just there's more power on large scales, and the small scale fluctuations are being suppressed. But because the shape here is still a power law, there's still a self-similarity. Now, if I were to magnify, I don't get something that's identical to the original field. I get something in which an overall, one way of saying it is this, if you were to magnify a subbox up to the size of the original box, you would get something statistically similar to the original, except that the overall normalization has been applied. Here's what's called a blue power spectrum. Red sometimes means more power on large scales than scale invariant. Blue means more power on small scales than scale invariant. So here I've just tilted things the other way. I've put in a positive power eval relative to the scale invariant case. And you see that most of the power is on small scales. If I exaggerate this even more and go to a constant, then I get what's called white noise. So a constant power spectrum is equivalent to the statement that each pixel is independent of each other of every other pixel. And so all I'm doing here is plotting like static, just an independent random number in every pixel of the image. Why is that true? Why is a constant power spectrum equivalent to there not being a correlation between pixels? Well, something that I said, but I left as a homework problem to prove, is that the power spectrum and the correlation function are Fourier transforms of each other. So if I Fourier transform a constant power spectrum, I get a correlation function, which is a delta function. And that just means that there's no off-diagonal correlation in the pixel basis. Okay. Now here's an example that I want to distinguish from the previous case of a red power spectrum, the L to the minus 3 case. So what I've done here is taken a scale invariant power spectrum, something proportional to 1 over L squared, and put in a cutoff, which is an exponential cutoff, which is equal to 1 on large scales, and then rapidly falls off when L is larger than some characteristic scale, L naught. And you can see that this random field is not self-similar anymore. There is some preferred scale in the map. So you just don't see any power. You just don't see any fluctuations on wavelengths below a certain value, you know, which by I, I'm going to say is maybe like this. But above that scale, if you were to sort of smooth things out and not look at the fluctuations below that scale, then things look scale invariant. So this is kind of different. Maybe even, yeah. So these two fields, you know, actually look the same on long wavelengths. So their long wavelength modes are identical. But this one has just been smoothed by the exponential cutoff. Here's another fun example. What if the power spectrum, I should have written C of L, is a delta function? Now, by a delta function, I mean a 1D delta function. So that the Fourier transform of this 2D field would look like a little ring. There would be a ring of non-zero values in the LX, LY plane with random phases. So an individual Fourier mode, an individual mode on that ring, would just look like some, you know, monochromatic plane wave with a given wavelength. But when I superpose a bunch of plane waves at the same wavelength with different orientations and phases, well, that's what I mean when I say I have a random realization of this power spectrum. And you can see it's not, you know, a perfectly monochromatic plane wave anymore, but there's some just very sharp, there is some very defined characteristic scale. There's sort of a characteristic chunkiness with a very well-defined wavelength. And that scale is just 1 over L naught, or maybe it makes more sense to call it pi over L naught, parametrically 1 over L naught. Here is a CMB power spectrum. So this has a lot more structure than the power spectra that I've been showing so far. There are two very evident features here. One is, you know, this acoustic peak scale. There's a peak at L of around 200, and then at odd multiples of 200, there's, you know, a second peak, a third peak, and so on. And so I kind of want to draw a loose analogy between that scale and the case of a delta function power spectrum. And then the other scale that is really jumps out here is the damping scale. You know, the peaks don't go on forever. There's a characteristic damping scale around, you know, maybe we could call it 1500, say, where the power spectrum exponentially suppresses. Of course, there's more structure here than just those two scales. There's also like the relative peak heights, which contain all sorts of interesting information in this plot. But these two numbers are all that you might be able to see by eye. Here's a simulated CMB map. I just simulated a Gaussian random field with the CMB power spectrum. This isn't real data, although the real data would look very similar. So one thing that I think you can, you know, see by eye really clearly in this map is the existence of a damping scale. You know, you just don't see power out to like the, you know, the resolution of the plot. Things are being are certainly being smooth relative to like say a scale invariant field. This map is sort of smoothed out on small scales. That characteristic scale in the CMB, by the way, is a few arc minutes. There just aren't hot and cold spots in the CMB smaller than a few arc minutes. Now, it is sometimes said, some of us sometimes say in plots, that you can also see the acoustic scale. You can definitely see the existence of a damping scale in this plot. It is also sometimes said that you can see the acoustic scale, or that you can see by eye, you know, there's this peak at L equals 200, that there's sort of a sharply defined scale that has a particular scale that has more hot and cold spots than you would sort of expect by chance. Sometimes when I look at these plots, I can decide that that's true. And sometimes I think I'm just being superstitious because I know the answer, you know. I'll leave it to you to look at these plots and decide whether you think that's true. I mean, maybe it's true. You can sort of see here, I mean, the acoustic scale is sort of this size. Like here's a spot, you know, with a particular size, and it kind of has the same size as this spot and this spot. But you know, if you compare to the scale invariant case, you can maybe see a little more variety in the sizes of hot and cold spots. I don't know. Maybe the lesson is that your eye is not a very good, aside from very grossly obvious features like the existence of the damping scale, the fact that the power spectrum is basically zero above a certain value of L. Your eye isn't a very good measurer of the power spectrum. If you were to, there's enough data in this image, by the way. If you just were to take the power spectrum of the image, which just means Fourier transforming it, squaring it, and plotting it, then you would have no problem in that plot seeing this acoustic peak structure. The acoustic peaks, the curve would be the error bars on the curve would be a few percent. So you would see multiple peaks. You would see this whole structure very visibly, but it's hard to see by eye. So just to kind of give a sense for how we actually do cosmology, I want to talk just for fun, and this is stuff that I'm going to try to explain later in the class, where the characteristic scales in the CMB come from. So remember, the CMB is obtained by linearly processing initial curvature perturbations with a featureless power spectrum. So the power spectrum of the initial fluctuations is scale invariant. It would be sort of flat in these units. Because of the physics that happens between inflation and formation of the CMB, all of that interesting physics generates the structure and imprints scales. So just for fun, let me say without proof where these scales come from. So between inflation and the formation of the CMB, the universe is a plasma, a sort of tightly coupled plasma. And so inhomogeneities propagate as sound waves in that plasma. The physics of the plasma is just the linear physics of sound waves. And there is one scale that exists is the what's called the sound horizon, which is just the maximum distance that a sound wave travels between the Big Bang and the time when the CMB forms. Now, when we observe the CMB, we observe it in an angular way. And so a given standard ruler, like the sound horizon, would span an angle on the sky given by, as we said before, the ratio between the sound horizon and the conformal look-back time to the CMB. And that is the underlying physical origin of this acoustic peak scale. You're measuring the ratio between two distances, the distance sound travels before the CMB is formed, to the distance between the CMB and us. I recall from memory, although I didn't check it, so don't quote me on this, that there's a factor of pi here. So I'd put the pi just to make it more official. Likewise, just for fun, let me say where the damping scale comes from. If you imagine following, so the CMB is formed when the universe transitions from being opaque to being transparent. But that isn't a perfectly instantaneous process. There's some sort of in-between period where the universe is gradually transitioning between being optically thick to optically thin. So imagine that I follow a photon back to the last scattering surface. There's a 7% probability, because the CMB optical depth tau is 0.07, that it's scattered off a photon at low redshift. But 93% of the time, you get the picture shown here, where you follow the photon all the way back to the surface of last scattering, and that's where the first, all the way back to the CMB surface, and that's the most recent time that the photon scattered off an electron. But then we can keep going. You know, the universe wasn't perfectly opaque then. So if we follow it back, there'll be some mean free path in a plasma that's neither perfectly optically thick nor perfectly optically thin. And then, you know, we could follow it back again. We get a little random walk going backward in time. Where I've drawn the arrows shorter and shorter as you go back, because the plasma is becoming more and more opaque, and it's harder and harder for the photon to do its random walk. So let lambda be the distance between the start of the random walk and this point, the last scatter in the random walk before the photon free streamed to us. So the length of that random walk, just to be a little pedantic, the total distance, by the way, means this distance, not the sum of the steps in all the random walk, but the total displacement that the photon experienced. So that random walk distance lambda, divided by the distance to the CMB, the distance between us and the surface of last scattering, that's the underlying origin of the damping scale. Why do I bring this up? Because the fact that these scales are imprinted in the observables is sort of the only reason that we can do cosmology and learn about cosmological parameters. If this processing and imprinting of scales never happened, and the power spectrum were, you know, scale invariant, flat as it is in the initial conditions, then we would not have any hope of inferring values for parameters like omega baryon, omega matter, and so on. But these scales turn out to be, because they involve so much physics, turn out to be sensitive to cosmological parameters. And so every time you measure one of these scales, you're measuring like one particular combination of numbers in the six-parameter space of the standard model. And it turns out, from what I've said so far, you might think that we're only constraining, you know, two numbers in a six-parameter space, leaving us with four more measurements we need to make somehow to complete things. But it actually turns out there's more information here, things I didn't talk about, like relative heights of the peaks and so on, that actually enable the CMB to pretty well pin down all six parameters of the standard model. I showed the CMB power spectrum. Here is what the matter power spectrum looks like in the late universe. If I were to let the universe evolve to redshift zero, and then take just the, you know, it has an inhomogeneous matter distribution, and that's a random field, and I can take its power spectrum. And this is what the power spectrum looks like. It's sort of one big bump, a lot less structure than the CMB power spectrum. So this characteristic scale is super important at a wave number k in units of inverse megaparsecs, which is always what we use for wave numbers. It's around 0.02. That characteristic scale turns out to be, that's another thing that we'll talk about later, the underlying physical origin of the scale is that it's the Hubble parameter, or you know, the Hubble length scale, evaluated at the redshift when matter and radiation had the same physical density. So that's a redshift of around 3,000. So this is a scale that corresponds to, say, well, the actual distance scale, the associated distance scale, it would probably make more sense to call that pi over, say, 0.02. So No, I don't want to say that. Let's say it's 1 over k. So a characteristic scale of about 50 megaparsecs, say. That's how large the universe is at matter radiation equality. So for what we've said about power spectra so far, well, let me show a plot, and then I'll talk through it. Here's a random field with the same power spectrum as the matter power spectrum on the late universe. So this is what the density fluctuations in the universe might look like if smoothed on a large scale. So one thing you can notice what that big bump means is that on large scales, the power spectrum is very suppressed. So if I go back to the original plot, this is falling off really fast on large scales. It actually falls off as, you can't quite read off the exponent in this plot, but it falls off as 4 powers of k relative to the scale invariant case on large scales. So one thing that you can see here is there's sort of a smoothing on small scales, which is the cutoff at high k. But there's also a smoothing on large scales. There's much less large scale power in this map than there is in the scale invariant case. And you can see that there's sort of big hot and cold regions here that aren't here. Like here's a big, a big long wavelength fluctuation where everybody is a positive number that's sort of been removed here. What this means is that if you look at matter fields in the late universe, there's not much correlation between parts of the universe that are separated by a distance of about 50 megaparsecs. And that fundamental scale really pervades cosmology, that matter radiation scale. Very loosely, you can think of the late universe as being cut up into a bunch of cells of characteristic size 50 megaparsecs or so. Although it's not a sharp cutoff, that's just the scale where things start to decorrelate as a power law as you go farther and farther away. The last slide I want to show, I just want to emphasize that for a Gaussian field, the power spectrum completely determines the statistics of the field. There's a formula for the full probability density as a function of the power spectrum. But many fields in cosmology are non-Gaussian. For example, here's the real density field, the nonlinear density field that you get out of a simulation. And here is a Gaussian random field with the same power spectrum. So even though these two fields have the same power spectrum, they are very statistically different, and just the power spectrum alone is not doing a good job of capturing the full information content of the field. The CMB is roughly Gaussian, but density fluctuations are not. But above a certain scale, on large scales, the Gaussian approximation is pretty good even for the density field. But it breaks down on small scales, as you can clearly see. So I just wanted to show some pictures because I think they're just kind of useful in attaching mental images to these random field concepts we're talking about. All right, I'm 5 minutes over time, so that's all for today. See you next time.
So the large scales is probably how large is it?
So you're asking, that's a great question. You're asking what is the scale above which Gaussian statistics are a good approximation. That characteristic scale turns out to be maybe 20 megaparsecs is a good number. It's comparable to the matter radiation equality scale. But those two scales being comparable is actually kind of a coincidence. It depends on like how much the fluctuations have grown between us and the CMB, and it's time dependent.
Okay, thanks everyone.